Shrink Wrap Radio number 736, Francis Weller on Grief and the Absence of the Ordinary.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Francis Weller, marriage and family therapist, is a psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist. He is a master of synthesizing diverse streams of thought from psychology, anthropology, mythology, alchemy, indigenous cultures, and poetic traditions. We're going to be discussing his recent book, In the Absence of the Ordinary, Essays in a Time of Uncertainty. Francis Weller, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. Welcome back. Welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's really good to see you again, David. I'm glad to be back with you.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you on again. And I say welcome back because you were my guest on episode number 279, discussing your book on grief, ritual, and the soul of the world. I guess getting ready for the situation that we find ourselves in now, because yeah, you were already wrestling with sort of profound philosophical and spiritual issues that we now find ourselves in. And over the 10 years since that podcast interview, you've really stayed on theme, deepening your work and your life and your practice. And out of all of that come your most recent publication, a collection of essays on the absence of the ordinary. And what an appropriate title that is, because we were talking a little bit before turning on the microphone here and just reflecting on how the life of children has changed compared to how it was when we grew up relatively wild. So I am so impressed by your writing, by this book, and I really wanted people to get a feel for your poetic soul, your poetic style of presenting yourself. And so I'm going to be asking you periodically. I've marked some passages from your book, and at first I was going to read some of them, but then I thought, well, it'd be so much better to have people experience it in your voice. And so I'll be cueing you. And I think let's start off with a quote from the introduction of the book. And it's that first quote.
Okay. It says, we are living in anxious times. Uncertainty has come into our homes and found its way into each of our lives. What was once stable and familiar has been shaken, and we have entered a steep descent into the unknown. Here the invisible world asserts its power, reminding us of the folly of control. In these times, it may not be the gods and goddesses affecting our fates, but something equally mysterious, something unseen moving through the air, rattling our deep psychic ground, affecting everything. Fear and anxiety readily appear in times like these. Our work is to turn towards these jittery guests and make a place at the table to offer tea and soup, a warm place to rest.
I really like that last line, and it sounds to me like an idea maybe that comes from Rumi, the idea of welcoming the guest. Talk to us a bit about that, because it's hard to think about what we're going through now as a welcome guest, at least on the surface, but you really invite us to revision it in some ways.
It's not that it's a welcome guest, but it's an inevitable guest right now. Mm-hmm. And so we can either resist that presence, the anxiety, the uncertainty, the fear, the dread, or we can begin to turn toward it and begin to find some way of warming it, staying close to it, and finding in it some sense of our communal thread. I mean, that's part of what I think is unraveling right now, is the fiction of individualism.
Ah.
You know, and that it's not my circumstance anymore. Even in my therapy practice, much of what's being referred to isn't personal intrapsychic material anymore. It's collective. It is intrapsychic. It's what's going on in the field. And so, are you afraid right now, David? You know, I think there's fear circulating around many of us.
There's fear there. I think my defense mechanisms mostly work pretty well for me, so that I don't dwell on the fear that much. But but as I mentioned before the interview, I've got two sets of grandkids in this area, and so I really fear for them, and I fear for my, you know, will I be able to hug them again ever? I mean, I'm getting up there in years, and we don't know when I'll be able to hug them and see them in person. That's a fearful part of it.
And that's the part we need to turn toward and have some kind of intimacy with those parts of us that are fearful, that are anxious. I mean, the other thing that's coming to mind for me is that what I'm experiencing is not mine, again, privately, but I am experiencing the ambient field of the collective experience of felt fear and dread and uncertainty and grief. I mean, my God, the levels of grief that are circulating through the atmosphere right now. We have, you know, well over 250,000 dead now in our country and over 2 million worldwide, and millions of families affected by, you know, unemployment, loss of jobs, economic fears. The grief levels are really saturating the field too. So we either become skillful at knowing how to navigate that territory, or we have to shut down.
Yeah, and again, I'm struck by the fact that you have been preparing for this for years. Your whole practice and work has been around grief and dealing with grief, and at a time when it wasn't really in our face the way it is now.
Yeah.
And so how are you finding that all of the inner work that you've done is serving you during this period in terms of having to deal with your own grief and sense of loss and fear and all of that?
Well, I think I'm very familiar with the territory. It doesn't mean I don't go through my own experiences of fear. I mean, about a month or so ago, I was heading to bed with a lot of dread in my body, just the heaviness. You know, I think there's an upcoming the election, and what was the results going to be around the election? And I think that's when the UN report on the global climate catastrophe was coming out, and I was just feeling this heaviness in my body. And wisely, I turned, maybe synchronistically, towards my bookshelf and pulled on a slender collection of essays by Linda Hogan called Dwellings. And I opened the book to the chapter, All My Relations. And I recognized how much my fear and dread had kind of closed me off. It had caused a kind of contraction in my soul, to my spirit, to my heart. And I was forgetting all of the tendrils of entanglement that I have with the moon and the stars and the ravens and the crows and the dug fir and the redwoods outside my home. And so I began to extend my tendrils back out there.
Yeah.
And I began to feel my wild entanglement with it all. Huh. And that helped me to really calm down internally.
And
feel more of my... that I am actually quite immense.
Yeah, that's a word that comes up in these essays quite a bit. You kind of call the reader to become immense.
Yes.
Yeah, so say a little bit more about that.
I think the first time I used that phrase when I was working at the Cancer Help Program down in Bolinas, which I helped to co-facilitate with Michael Lerner a couple times a year. And as I'm sitting with these people facing these dreadful diagnoses at times, and how much our psychological conditioning is geared towards positivism.
Yeah.
You know, stay hopeful, keep positive, you know, stay loving. And that's fine. But what about all those parts of me that are dreading, that are fearful, that are, you know, aware of the presence of death and disappearance and endings and suffering? I think what we're being asked to do is get our arms around both of these presences.
Mm-hmm.
And that I would say to them, you know.
And that's immense. Yeah, that is immense.
That's our immensity.
Yeah, that's a lot to.
As James Hillman would once said, you know, the issue is rarely about resolution. It's about spaciousness. How big can we get?
Uh-huh.
How much can we include in our encounter with our own humanness? And this is certainly part of our humanness, right? Fear and dread and grief and death and suffering. My God. But our psychology is so heroic and so bent towards positivism. And
particularly in America. We have listeners all over the world here. But I think the rest of the world has seen that in us sometimes more clearly than we could see it in ourselves. I'd like to move you on to your next quote. Which is, you see it there, right?
Yeah, there are shifts happening along the fault lines of this evolving crisis. The insane pace of modernity is being brought to a screeching halt. The dominant ideology of power and privilege is cracking, coaxing a more compassionate and heartfelt response to our mutually entangled lives. Suddenly, productivity is not the primary value, but connection, affection, love, encouragement. In the pause of sheltering in place, we remember neighbors and kindness, mutuality and empathy. So now what? How do we navigate this tidal surge of uncertainty? How do we engage the world in the absence of the ordinary?
And those, of course, are the key questions, you know. So now what? As you say here, how do we navigate this tidal surge of uncertainty? And I liked earlier, too, where you said the dominant ideology of power and privilege is cracking, it's coaxing a more compassionate and heartfelt response to our mutually entangled lives. So there again, you bring up the idea that although we may not be physically present with one another, we are connected in multiple ways.
Yes. I mean, I see this really as a time of endings. It's the ending the fiction of individualism, ending the fiction of supremacy of all kinds, whether it's supremacy over nature or supremacy over other races or other genders. These fictions are being radically challenged by the circumstances we're facing. Because none of them actually have any solidity to them. They're built on, well, if we really went into this deeply, we'd go back into the whole experience of individualism leading to a profound sense of emptiness at the core of our being.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in white Western culture. And how have we attempted to compensate for that emptiness? Well, through consumption, through control, through domination, through privilege, through power, through rank, and all these are strategies to cope with this feeling of emptiness. But none of that, they're all hollow.
Yeah.
They're built upon a true sense of emptiness. And so what we have to do actually is courageously turn and face our own emptiness. Our own, we was at some point along our cultural trajectory out of European countries, we lost the connective tissue to our ancestry, to ritual, to story, to land, to food, to landscape. All of these things kind of got cut off. And we have become what Stephen Jenkinson calls an orphaned people. And we don't know how to deal with that. There's tremendous grief that we would have to acknowledge.
An orphanage people?
An orphaned people.
An orphaned people?
Yeah. That's a huge topic.
And so there, at the same time, there's an opportunity in this as well, right? Because with the death, you know, you said a lot is coming to an end. And when you say that, I feel it in my body. I mean, there's a resistance that comes up, you know, no, I don't want it. I don't want it all to end. But there's a real opportunity to, and this maybe sounds like American optimism again, you know, it's hard to get rid of it altogether. An opportunity to reinvent ourselves, to rise to the challenge, etc.
If we can really be willing to not grasp for answers too soon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're big on solutions, but I think our solutions are oftentimes predicated on the same premises that got us into the trouble in the first place.
Yeah.
That's why these endings, I think, are so essential. This is a time, I often call it, we're entering a period of the long dark, which may last decades or generations. I don't know how long this is going to last.
Right.
This is not a time of optimism, of, you know, rising up and success. This is a time of descent. And this is the direction of soul. As you know from all of your work and all of your conversations, that soul leads us downward.
Yes.
Into the depths, where we deal with vulnerability and death and intimacy and our entanglements with the world and with one another. This is a holy ground, and it leads us into darkness, and that scares the crap out of us.
Right.
Because we're very much an ascension culture. We like the light. We like things bright and shining so we know where we're standing. But we're being led into the darkness, into a very shadowed territory where we're much more closer to being on our knees and kind of brailing our way through our next steps rather than certainty and control. We may have to give up all of those fictions.
What was the word you just used? We are what on our way? Brailing, it sounded like?
Brailing, yeah, like braille, like reading.
Like reading braille, like having to feel your way along the trail.
Yeah.
On hands and knees, okay.
On our hands and knees. It's a very humble time.
Yeah.
But we can be maybe redreamt by the earth.
Yeah.
And reimagined.
Again, it's hard to accept, you know, when you say we're entering a long darkness. I think some of us are rallying right now in very positive ways.
Yes.
And, but a long darkness, a long challenge, that could be a whole different thing.
I think that's part of our ripening as human beings right now is to face the reality of what we're hearing. I mean, we might be able to make some major alterations in our racist history. I'm praying for that.
Yeah.
I'm doing whatever I can for that. We might be able to make some real progress around our economic disparities. Where we're going to hit the road most concretely is in climate change.
Yeah.
This one is going to affect every human being on the planet. That's the one that we are really having to brace for and to develop our own internal resiliencies and our communal resiliencies. So that's soul work as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
How do we deal with difference? How do we deal with conflict? How do we deal with, you know, conflicting needs? How do we deal with building in the old ideology, in the old indigenous tradition, the cosmos was built on community first, family second, and the individual last. That was the cosmology. We have inverted that entirely in white mm-hmm. Western culture. Mm-hmm. Individual first, family second, and community is kind of an abstract rhetoric. So we have to begin to reimagine this again. We have to begin to reimagine what would a thriving local community look like. Because if that community is thriving, I will be okay. It's no longer survival of the singular. It's no longer about private salvation. It's no longer about looking after number one. Again, those are all fictions that are decaying and dying, and there's only one way through, and that way, you know, there's only one way through, and that is together.
I grew up, I think I'm a loner. I have been a loner quite a bit in my life, hanging tight with a very small group of friends. And so that will require a big adjustment on my part, I think. I grew up on cowboy movies and James Bond movies and things like that, where there was a strong, mostly solitary hero that come in and kind of rescue the situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that myth is inappropriate right now.
I think so.
Let me cut in here to tell you about today's sponsor, Magic Spoon, an amazing new breakfast cereal. You'll immediately recognize the familiar shape of this new cereal, each piece a tiny circle. We've all been told that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. The shape may be familiar, but this cold cereal is an entirely new experience. For example, there's no sugar, there are 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, with only 140 calories a serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. And there are 4 flavors in the variety pack they'll send you. The flavors are cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. I've personally tried all 4 flavors with both almond milk and regular whole milk and found them to be delicious either way, and even more so after adding my usual blueberries and banana slices. One of the things I like most about Magic Spoon is the crunchy texture that doesn't get soggy. So go to magicspoon.com/shrink to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code SHRINK at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/shrink and use the code SHRINK to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Now, back to the interview.
Yeah. I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh who said that the next Buddha would not come as an individual, but as a community.
Wow.
And I think the next healers, I think the next culture shapers, they're not going to be so much individuals, but communal gatherings. I mean, we will shape things together.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to honor your introverted nature. I'm an introvert too. I love my solitude. I need it. But I can also feel, it's what I call the double helix, the twining trail of the soul. The soul has a simultaneous need for sovereignty and intimacy, for a deep interior life and a communal life, simultaneously. Now, every one of us will have a lean towards one or the other. You know, I definitely lean more towards that sovereignty piece of my own solitude. It's where I do my writing, my thinking, my work is very private with people. But I've also had to learn how to do more community building and to bring those values into community. So I think we'll all be asked to do both.
Yeah. I think maybe I should ask you to give us some sense of what you mean by soul. You know, for me, it's kind of like Louis Armstrong's thing, you know, you can't define it, but you know it. You feel it in your body. But when you say soul, you know, because I came up in a fundamentalist Christian cosmology that I no longer subscribe to. So you're not necessarily, when you say soul, you're not necessarily talking about a personality that exists after death, or are you?
That's kind of beyond my pay grade, but what I would say is that I'm not talking about a metaphysical idea of soul, but a deeply, well, it's both deeply intimate, deeply personal. It's my most interior experience of being, kind of somewhat separate than my sense of self. It has a deeper foundation, a more archaic root system, I would say, that tangles down into the commons of the human experience. The commons of the soul would be grief and loss and death and vulnerability, tenderness, friendship, love, longing, beauty, imagination. These are the ingredients that go into the geography of soul.
Okay.
But it's kind of the integral twin to the ascension rising spirit and the descension oriented soul. Soul takes us down into the earth. Spirit tends to rise us up to the mountaintops. So we have the difference between Handel's Messiah singing Alleluia, the great Alleluia, so celestial, so uprising. Then we have Leonard Cohen singing Alleluia.
Yeah.
Same words, very different feeling tone.
Right.
Dropped in English. It's the broken Hallelujah, he calls it. That's soul. It takes us into our bodies, into the grit of life, into the messiness of life. Spirit tends to like clarity and vision and far-off seeing, whereas soul likes things close in and very...
I love his line, there's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in. What a beautiful one-liner.
Yeah. His soul has no problems with our mistakes, with our failings. It uses everything in our life as the core material. As an alchemy would say, it's the prima materia. Yeah. It's the stuff of life, and it's what it works with. So it doesn't care about our histories, if we've been, you know, abandoned or hurt, or that's just the material of life, and it will use it all to shape it.
Yeah. You've got another quote here that starts with a powerful assertion. Social distance is a cold term. Give us that quote, if you will.
Social distance is a cold term, lacking any sense of the rich invitation that awaits us when we turn toward our internal worlds. Solitude is a state of hospitality, a welcoming of all that is in need of attention.
Yeah, and that's what you were just talking about, was the importance of solitude. And solitude, talk to us about solitude and loneliness. There's a lot of loneliness out there right now.
Solitude is, there's a line of Rilke's, Rainer Marie Rilke, where he said, I am too alone in the world, but not alone enough to make every moment holy. Now there's the two. There's isolation. I'm too alone in the world. I'm cut off from everything. I'm separate, segregated, in a sense, in solitary confinement. Then he makes this luscious pivot, but not alone enough to make every moment holy. That's solitude. In my solitude, we have the chance of really dropping into the depth of our being. And as Jung would say, the depth of our being is everything. We find our kinship with all things in the depths of our being.
So we have a bit of a choice here, right? To either go into our fear and panic about being alone, cut off from other people,
right,
or to use it as a soul building opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, I want to have, again, great empathy and compassion for extroverts. Some of my people I'm working with in my practice are extroverts, and this is really stressing the hell out of them. It's really hard to cut off from.
I thought about that and wondered, you know, if that's true.
For me, you know, and probably for you, it's stressful, but I'm very comfortable being in my home and being alone with my wife and, you know, just in this little cocoon of a space. But for some others, it's really quite difficult to hold that space. So it does become kind of an interior soul practice. Can I keep turning toward the parts of me that are uncomfortable, that are frightened, that are feeling lonely? I remember I shared in my book on grief, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, a story of a woman I was working with. And she came in one day. She said, "I just hate going home at night." She was going through a very ugly divorce. She said, "I just hate going home at night." And I said, "Why is that?" She said, "Well, when I get there, it's cold, it's dark, it's empty, it's lonely, it's you know, I hate it." And I said, "Well, can you imagine it as the holiest time of day? That when you open the door, you're meeting your most vulnerable self, the part of you that feels lonely, it feels cold. And can you speak to this part of you? Can you say, let's turn on the tea, let's light the fire, let's make some places of warmth for us? Can you be a place of welcoming to this part of you?" And that's when I remember that quote of Rilke's about making that pivot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now,
can this become a time of holiness, of solitude, of, you know, deep soul work?
You also talk a lot about initiation, and I know that you've led initiation rituals over the years, and you're kind of known in this Sonoma County for that work. You suggest that we're being called to an initiation, and you say it's a rough initiation. What can you tell us about rough initiations? Is there any other kind?
Well, yes, there are. A traditional initiation that would be held in an intact village community, tribal community, is what I call a contained encounter with death. And the containment is provided by the community, by the elders, by the ritual, by the ancestors, by the land, by the space and time set apart from the community. That all provides a profound containment field for this unraveling of our psychic lives.
Yeah, and also the fact that it's embedded in a tradition. It's something that we have done for millennia,
exactly,
our people.
Yes, and so you see
the
evidence.
But we don't quite have that built into our culture.
No, we have almost none of that.
Yeah.
Now, this rough initiation idea came out of the Cancer Help Program, because I began looking at their experience and seeing the parallels between what was happening to them and what happens in traditional initiation. There are three things that typically happen. There's a severance from the world that you once knew. Mm-hmm. So the initiate is taken out of his or her or their family setting, and they're escorted outside the village. You get a phone call one day and say, or you're going into see your doctor, they say, "It's positive. You have breast cancer. You have glioblastoma. You've got, you know, liver cancer." Or you've left the world that you've been in. Up until that moment, you were a certain person.
Yeah.
And that world is shattered in that moment, which leads to the second thing that happens in initiation. There's a radical alteration in your sense of identity. Who I was is no more. I've heard, I can't tell you how many times at the cancer program, "I don't know who I am anymore." And of course, we hear that in therapy. We hear that, we probably have felt that in our own lives from time to time when things unravel. And the third thing is there's a sense that we could never return to the world that was. Hmm. And in initiation, you don't want to return to the world that was. That's one of the fallacies in Western medicine and Western psychology. We'll get you back to where you were before the fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
That would be wasting a perfectly good cancer, heart attack, depression, you know, or now global crisis. We don't want to go back to where we were. This is an invitation for some type of new revelation of how we have to, maybe it's an old revelation, of how we have to once again return to and restore our relationships to one another and to the land base, to our watersheds. We can't continue to do this anymore.
What's the third word that you used? You had a word for the first and second and what, stage three of initiation?
There's a profound sense you can never return to the world that was.
Oh, that is? Okay, that is it.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's radical severance, alteration of identity, and there is no return.
And therefore, you have to be born again in some way.
We have to undertake the ordeal as an obligation, as a kind of a, how should I say it? This is the opportunity right now that we're facing towards a collective movement towards maturation. We have been living, particularly in white Western culture, in a very adolescent fashion. What can I get? What's in it for me? Even our psychology is about self-improvement. You know, it's about me. Initiation, as far as I've ever studied it, was never about the individual. It was always a ripening of the individual for the sake thereof. You were prepared to become someone who could caretake and help sustain the village, the watershed, mm-hmm. the animal life, the food sources. You were being prepared to take your place as a member in a functioning community.
Yeah, yeah. You got a great quote around that, the next quote here.
Which will, how we respond?
The immediate need of our time.
Oh, where's that one?
I don't know if I skipped something or not. I could read that one.
Sure. Why don't you read that one?
Okay. The immediate need of our time is ripened and seasoned, is for ripened and seasoned adult human beings to take their place in our communities. Individuals who carry a deep and abiding fidelity to the living body of this benevolent earth, to beauty and to their own souls. Traditionally, these were the ones who had successfully crossed a series of initiatory thresholds and had come through as protectors and carriers of the communal soul. They were the ones whose artistry and wisdom kept the current culture alive. We live in a society that has all but abandoned rituals of initiation. Consequently, we are languishing from the absence of mature and robust adults.
Amen.
That says it very powerfully. And does that mean that... Yeah, are we all called to be mature and robust adults, or are there certain people who are called to that because they're more equipped to go to that stage?
I did a series of talks called The Alchemy of Initiation, and it began with a premise that initiation is not optional. So I think every human being is called to this threshold.
Uh-huh.
And I begin with a few other premises, you know, that life itself, even in the absence of traditional initiations, will find ways to take you to the edge of your own ripening. But the third premise is you can still miss the bus.
Yeah.
There is no guarantee.
Right, even no guarantee.
Even if you've been given all of the ingredients, like trauma and suffering and wounds and, you know, losses and failure. Those are all ripening conditions for maturation. But you can still remain adolescent in your response to it.
Mm-hmm.
We've certainly seen this in our political arena of late, where we know that certain characters in this drama have had very difficult childhoods. But did they use the material to ripen, or did they use it to develop a strategic life of maintaining domination and control? So there's no guarantee that you're going to break through to that other side and become a ripened adult. But the invitation's always going to be there.
Yeah.
I believe this, everyone.
This also puts me in mind of a previous interview with a guy with a background in divinity, both in psychology and divinity, John Robinson, who has written about the call to elders, to those of us who've got gray hair and so on, that this is an opportunity for us to step forward and provide some leadership. Not just an opportunity, but a responsibility, as you said.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the elders are shaped in the fires of loss and grief.
Yeah.
You know, and how courageous can we be to keep our face turned into those winds right now? And again, to be broken open to our deep entanglement with the wider world, rather than, again, my own self-preservation. But how do I show up in a robust manner right now for the needs of the youth?
Yeah.
They're looking for
us. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I say they're looking for us.
Yeah. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. You've got one of your essays is titled An Apprenticeship with Sorrow. And I didn't know about your cancer work until I read your bio. And so I didn't know that you were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it strikes me that doing that cancer work must be an apprenticeship with sorrow. I mean, that you sort of deliberately walked into that painful place with people to do that. What can you tell us about that work and how it's affected you, maybe changed you?
It's ironic because, I should say that the most obvious thing that happens when you're sitting in a group of people who are dealing with a life-threatening diagnosis is that they are no longer in denial about all of us having a life-threatening diagnosis. We're all terminal. So it becomes foreground rather than background.
Yeah.
And what happens when it becomes foreground is there's a certain distillation of vision. You begin to look at things more immediately for what has to happen now. And it's ironic that lots of our conversations in our group time together, when I'm leading the group process, isn't so much about cancer, but about the unlived life, about the times of self-abandonment and self-betrayal, the dreams that got neglected, and parts of us that have been pushed to the margins of our life, you know, our sadness or our losses, or they come much more acutely into the foreground of our life. So they're being asked to really, again, practice that immensity, to begin to welcome everything. So we often begin our sessions by saying, what's present right now? What is wanting your attention? It's frequently grief, fear, loneliness, some abandoned story, some old memory. These things come crashing to the foreground now, asking for some acknowledgement. You know, but I would just say the apprenticeship idea, David, is a little different. The apprenticeship is the idea that every single day in every one of our lives, we will witness some thread of grief. You know, every one of us walking down the streets, looking into each other's eyes, no one is immune to loss. No one is immune to suffering. And right now, we're also beginning to become aware of more and more day by day of the greater, wider threads of loss to species, to, you know, ecosystems, to glaciers. There was a catastrophe yesterday. Was it in China, Tibet, I think, or India, where a glacier broke and a flood of water just drowned 200 people. So again, these symptoms are not over there. They are in my body too. I remember when they, in 2010, when the oil spill happened in the Gulf, I would wake up at night hearing the cries of dolphins and of shorebirds 2,000 miles away. I heard them and I would weep in the middle of the night for my kin. Now, I think that's also part of our maturation. This apprenticeship, in the old language of apprenticeship, you would take on a long study with a weaver, a painter, a farrier, a stonemason. And over that time, you would end up be called a master in that craft. In the soul apprenticeship with sorrow, the prolonged apprenticeship with grief doesn't lead to mastery. It leads to elderhood. That is the making of the elder. Mm-hmm. Someone who has undertaken this long apprenticeship and has had a fidelity to that for that long stretch of time, you are ripened by that relationship. You are deepened by it. It's like you're carved out like a riverbed and deepened by that apprenticeship so that you can hold much and you can turn your, again, you can be a presence for those who are suffering in our communities.
Yeah. I guess that's why some black and white photos of people with very wrinkled and cracked faces, but they bring forth, you see the kind of the way that their face has eroded through the trials and conditions of their life.
Yeah. I think the word character actually comes from the way that water can make etchings on stone. So our character shows on our skin, you know, we're weathered. Yeah. We are weathered.
Yeah.
By time.
Yeah.
But this apprenticeship is recognizes again that we will not be immune from suffering and that it is something we must undertake. You know, because the sorrows of the world, our own personal losses around our parts of ourselves that have been shamed and denied, and the losses of those that we love, our homes, our beloved cat just died 2 weeks ago, and we're just still missing her terribly.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Every day we look for her little, you know, presence in the house. She's gone.
Yeah.
You know, we're always being touched by grief, and there's the ancestral grief that we are really having to negotiate now around racism, slavery, and genocide to Native cultures. And I mean, that's why we have to take up the apprenticeship, because grief is around us all the time.
Uh-huh.
And we either undertake that disciplined approach to it, or again, the heart has to shut down.
There's a quote here that I'll read that says what you're saying. It's, you know, you don't really need to be quoted because you express all of this so well just in speaking. You write, grief and loss touch us all, arriving at our door in many ways. It comes swirling on the winds of divorce, the death of someone dear, an illness that alters the course of our life. For many of us, grief is tied intimately to the ravages we witness daily, to watersheds and forests, to the extinction of species, the collapse of democracy, and the fading of civilization. Left unattended, these sorrows can seep underground, darkening our days. It is our unexpressed sorrows, the congested stories of loss, that when left untouched, block our access to the vitality of the soul. To be able to freely move in and out of the soul's inner chambers, we must first clear the way. This requires finding meaningful ways to speak of sorrow. It requires that we wake up an apprenticeship with sorrow, learning to welcome, hold, and metabolize sorrow is the work of a lifetime. Our apprenticeship begins when we come to understand that grief is ever present in our lives. This is a difficult realization, but one that has the opportunity of opening our heart to a deeper love for our singular life and for the windswept world of which we are a part. We begin with a simple gesture of picking up the shards of grief that lie littered on the floor of our house. Nothing special, nothing heroic, not unlike the young novices entering their apprenticeship with the master teacher who began humbly sweeping the shavings, mixing the pigments, cleaning the brushes, tending the fires. We begin the process by building our capacity to hold sorrow in the womb of the heart. Through this patience, we become able to welcome the pervasive and encompassing presence of grief. So beautifully written, so very poetic and touching.
Thank you, David.
Really.
Yeah.
And it really, you were saying it in other words, but it really captures what you were saying, what we were just discussing, and just wraps it in a beautiful bundle.
It's not the easiest spiritual work to do, but it is the most necessary, I think, right now.
Yeah.
I often talk about it in terms of soul activism. You know, I tell the story of driving up north on 101, or maybe it was 1, and coming across a clear cut. Yeah. And my whole body, and I'm sure you've had that experience, our whole body reacts to that. Like some violation has occurred here.
Yeah. I've seen video of flight over our old redwood forests where the people who are in cars, they see on either side lovely forest.
Yep.
But from the air, you see all this land that is just stripped bare. Oh, that's so painful.
That's so painful. Now, that's our obligation to register that. Yeah. We are, I think, as human beings, we are the receptor sites for the sorrows of the world. Mm. And if our hearts are closed because of overwhelm or numbing or, forgetfulness, and we do not take up this apprenticeship, who's going to register these rips and tears in the bodies of the world? That's our moral and spiritual obligation, I think, right now, to be the mouthpiece for the sorrel, for the ferns, for the mushroom, for the for the trees, for the owls, for all those beings who cannot protest. See, grief is not just an emotion. It is a core human faculty. And one of the core faculties of that grief is protest, is to say enough is enough is enough, and to put our bodies on the line and say, this cannot happen any longer.
Yeah.
Grief is a confirmation or an indication of affinity. I grieve for the suffering of what I love, of what is partly who I am. See, we live with that fiction again, back to individualism, that's not me. That's just a forest over there, and I'm in my own encapsulated isolation. But how can I possibly? I'm breathing what they're exuding. I am their breath. I am the trees, express. I am the continuation of the tree's exhalation.
Yeah.
So we are completely.
And also, all other human beings are having this exchange of gases, breathing. Yeah.
So grief and the apprenticeship are really about that deep soul obligation, that soul activism to register what is happening to our world and to begin to do whatever we can to preserve, which ties us back in, if I can, one more thought, to initiation.
Yeah.
That initiation, again, was never meant for the individual. It was meant for the sake of the community. So you see in tribal cultures that are still intact, when an oil company or a fracking company comes in to begin to destroy their land base, it is an assault to their own being They're not doing it out of moral obligation. Like, we should protect this land. You're attacking us. The land and the people through initiation are fused. This is my body that you're assaulting. Now, that kind of deep connective tissue that comes out of that ritual practice is something that we have to begin to reimagine again, you know, so that we can begin to feel that we are part of this. Not, again, that's not because we should, but because our heart beat and the earth beat are the same.
That's such a good wrap-up that I think maybe, you know, I've got more quotes and all that we could discuss, but I think you've just really kind of given us a good condensation of what's in this this wonderful collection that you've written. And I'm going to recommend it highly to people. It's what under 100 pages, I think, and yet it is under 100 pages, right?
Yeah, right now it's just printed out about 8.5 by 11. It's a PDF, and it will be put into a book form soon. But right now it's just an e-book, and it will be published soon.
Yeah.
But thank you.
Yeah. It's just wonderful. So, Francis, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio. And one part of me wants to say I wish it was under better circumstances. Another part says this is the appropriate thing for us to be doing right now, and I'm glad that I have the opportunity to do it with you.
These are our circumstances, and hopefully, you know, through what you're doing, what we're doing, it will embolden people to engage what is happening right now at the depths of what is being asked of us. So thank you so much for having me be part of your program.
I hope you found Francis Willer to be as wise, grounded, and visionary as I do. I have to say I feel honored to be in his presence, even on Zoom. There was material we didn't get to in the interview. His book is divided into four sections, one of which is titled Care of the Soul, and it's divided into six topics that I had planned to ask him to talk to us about, how we can nurture and care for our soul. I'll read the six topic headings, and maybe you can get a sense of what he might have said based on what was already covered in the interview. The six subtopics under care of the soul are grandeur of the soul, reverence, the art of vesseling, the gift of restraint, the value of repetition, and the generous heart. There were also a couple other powerful quotes from the book that we didn't get around to. Here's one. Quote, "We are all preparing for our own disappearance, our one last breath. It's difficult to pick up this thread and hold it in our hand. Each of us is fated to leave this shining world, to slip off this elegant coat of skin, to release our stories to the wind, and return our bones to the earth. Saying goodbye, however, is not easy, or something we give much thought to in our daily lives. How do we say goodbye? How do we acknowledge all that has held beauty and value in our lives, those we love, those who touched our lives with kindness, those whose shelter allowed us to extend ourselves into the world? How do we let go of sunsets and making love, pomegranates and walks on the bluff? And yet we must. We must release the entire fantastic world with one last breath. We will all fall into the mystery. We are most alive at the threshold of loss and revelation." Let's pause for a moment to let that sink in. Here's another powerful quote. Quote, Whatever lies ahead will be shaped by the strength of our convictions. James Hillman wrote that the world and the gods are dead or alive according to the condition of our souls. I believe this is true. When we tend to the vitality of our soul, we keep the world humming. In the days to come, everything we do will be significant. Never doubt that each of us is essential to the welfare of the village. Everyone is a vector. Choose what you spread. Close quote. So in closing, let me say that Francis offers no easy answers. Indeed, he warns of the rough initiation ahead. He calls us to embrace the full magnitude of our current dark moment and those to come, while simultaneously wrapping our arms around the light. I strongly recommend you get yourself a copy of Francis's book, which he assures me will be out on Amazon soon. Attention! I just got word from Francis that you can currently download his book for free from his website, which is www.franciswellar.net.
Hi, I'm Amy Fellman, longtime listener of Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio is like the best textbook I've ever owned. I've learned so much, I was even inspired to start my own podcast. I recently donated to Dr. Dave to show my gratitude for all the hard work and amazing content that he puts out there for us across the world. I hope that he's able to continue his quest in providing everything we need to know about psychology and just enough to make us dangerous. I encourage you all to do the same. I have to say, it feels really good. Thanks again, Dr. Dave. And for all you listeners out there just like me, bite the bullet and donate.
Thank you, Amy Fellman in Melbourne, Australia, for that sterling and spirited recommendation. I'm glad to hear you finally decided to bite the bullet and donate. And as always, I want to thank all of our regular donors out there. Your names are on the honor roll on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And once again, I've been going through and updating donors from 2020 to 2021. So not only do I get to review the names of you faithful supporters of this work, but also to experience fresh gratitude for your continuing support in this new year. A big thank you to all of you folks. And with that, we'll wrap it up once again. Thanks so much to today's guest, Francis Weller, MA, for discussing his new book of essays titled In the Absence of the Ordinary. He definitely gave us soul food. My guest next week will be psychoanalyst Corinne Mazur, PhD, discussing her book, Finding the Piggle, reconsidering D.W. Winnicott's most famous child therapy case. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.